bandwidth for the Weird Things podcast provided by Wired Tree. For sites of any size and world-class customer service, head on over to WiredTree.com.
Hello and welcome to the Weird Things podcast. I'm Adrian Main, joined by Brian Brushwood.
Hello, beautiful people.
Justin Robert Young.
Hello.
And Bryce Castillo.
Hi, everybody. That's me.
Gentlemen, I don't know about you. When I was a kid, I loved space. I loved rockets.
Oh, well, thank goodness right? You gave that up.
Yeah, I know. But I wasn't one of those jerks that got to go to space camp.
All right. I've been a little personal. That's fine.
Oh, I forgot, Brian. You went to space camp. You were one of those lucky kids that got to go to space camp.
I also went and performed at the university and got to go back again to space camp as an adult.
It's great. It's great, Brian. Just really happy my friends could have these experiences. It's great. What about this, though, Brian? Did you get to touch a rocket? Did you get to see a rocket, like, up close?
I mean, the Huntsville campus has, like, you know, literally, you know, dozens and dozens. And, you know, you got to see the prototype for the nuclear-fueled one that was intended to go to Mars.
Wait. I'm sorry. You said at campus. Oh, so you had to go travel to go see this, right?
Well, yeah. I stayed there for a week. It was really great.
Well, you know, some Chinese students, they got an up close view of a rocket last week, and they didn't have to go very far, Brian. They could stand at their own school and watch as a Long March 4B rocket launched and then crashed not that far away from their school. And they got an up close view of this, Brian.
Hooray doodle. I don't know. Wait, what is the right response on this?
Wow.
Well,
all
Brian.
Right. So, yeah, this is a Chinese rocket launch ends in failure. But where are they launching it that it's that close to a school? That seems like a poor idea.
They launch from inland, right? And they have a habit of sometimes if there's a town not far from where they launch the rockets from, then, hey, these people get a great view. Cool. In this case, this is not the first time. I think we saw some footage before of a rocket that crashed like on the middle of a road. You see pieces of the rocket on the road. Here, they're using the hydrazine gas, which gives that toxic orange cloud. And you look at some of the photos of this and you see like from the school, we see this orange cloud. That's the thing that like when we have that, we clear everybody as far back as possible from. You know, China, it's like a couple guys in hazmat suits hose it down and then like, all right, everybody's good to go.
Is the hydrazine the same stuff that is a plot device in The Martian? Isn't that what he uses to make oxygen or water from and then does too much?
Yeah, I think he splits apart the hydrazine.
Yeah.
So, which was unnecessary given The Martian. That's fine.
It's also couldn't happen.
No, but it's one of those things that you're like, if
oh
you're
my
like,
god, you, that is a rocket falling to the planet. Oh my god!
So we're seeing the orange cloud from a street. Yeah, we're seeing
orange,
debris.
The toxic orange cloud.
Oh dear.
There's a shot of the orange cloud with the school in the foreground.
Oh dear.
Jiminy.
So that's close.
The yelling that you heard was the compilation video going from a falling celestial body to then just a gigantic plume of awful smoke and destruction.
It looks right now like the first part of when SpaceX lands a rocket. Now it doesn't because it's starting to go sideways and the thrusters haven't turned on and now there's a big plume.
Wow. Were they trying to? I assume they were trying to go to space. That's a dumb thing for me to say.
They did.
This was not
orange
like
cloud successful.
Exactly.
Back it up.
No, so wait, my question was like they weren't trying to land a rocket.
Scientifically speaking, was this for funsies?
That's not what I meant. You understand what I meant.
Or was it for realsies? Answer the question, sir. Answer the question.
I didn't know. We've watched a lot of SpaceX start, you know, hops, and I didn't know if it was one of those. But no, apparently they were really shooting for the stars and didn't make it. Oh,
yeah. They landed among the orange clouds.
Yeah. Hey, man, when you reach for the stars, sometimes you just end up in a cloud.
Sometimes you end up in a Chinese school gymnasium.
Oh, my God.
So China has a very, and they've made a lot of progress in their space industry. Now, I want to make that clear. They've made a lot of rapid progress. They've took, they started a lot of the Soviet era designs. They've been iterating on that, trying to develop their own. We think they launched a space plane recently, but, you know, being military and secretive, they haven't quite, you know, we don't have the full details on that. Kind of like our X-37B, which we've been using for decades to test things on. So it looks like they just launched something like that. They do have a splody sort of problem, which not to say that we haven't gone through that either, but there is like there's some of their rockets have to have a kind of a higher rate of that. But they're making a lot of progress. Like,
just try to spell the name Elon Musk with four less F words. That's how like they apparently have fewer F's to give about whether or not something makes it harder, faster.
Well, I mean, there's also, you know, there is a thing to be said about certain engineering cultures and stuff too. Like you look at the problems that we had, you know, we've had like with the shuttle where we've had a couple instances where we knew there were design flaws, but the ability for that to make it all the way up, there was systemic problems of like, no, we think this is the error margin. And some engineers like, no, that's not what it should be. Like, nope, we've got the document right here. It says you're wrong. And then it blows up and it's like, oh, that document doesn't exist anymore. And, you know, a lot of like our own cover our butts on stuff. So in there, I think that it's even, I don't, you know, you don't want to be the engineer that has to say we can't launch today, you know, when it's a really important launch. So, but they've made progress and they're ambitious about space. So I you know, I respect towards that. And I don't want to be like, ha, look at them, but
no,
launching stuff close to schools, maybe not the best idea.
But man,
that would be, I mean, all right. Can we imagine if this were in the United States, like what we would be looking at in terms of fallout, in terms of who would be fired, like that this would be a massive story, right? Like, well, this would be a story that would go on for weeks or months.
No, the story would be that thank goodness that there are no kids in that school because we're all staying home on our Zoom meetings.
But fair point. For context, I was told that SpaceX took several years to get permission to launch from Vandenberg because there was a threatened snail near the launch pad.
Yeah.
Like literally because of an environmental impact involving a snail. Nothing against snails. And it's like, that don't happen in China. You got a GD school in the way and they're launching.
The threatened snail wasn't even threatened with its life. It was threatened. There was collateral that was about to be released that would be very embarrassing for that snail.
Yes. Yes, for that snail who had made a vow. That is I can't even wrap my head around the idea of something that would need as high level and thorough sign-offs from city, state, federal, all of the agencies that deal with our current orbital path through space. Like, there are few actions in our current system that require as many people to sign off on them than a space launch from every form of government. The idea that something would fall very, very close to a school is just crazy. Like that would be heads would roll.
They might have.
Fair point. That's a fair point.
I was in China and I had a friend who, she was from Hong Kong. Her husband was from Belgium, and he worked at this company and they made something, and it was a Chinese company, and he went to go work with them from Europe because they were like the best Chinese company building the stuff, you know, because he talks about like Chinese companies, like a lot of them just sort of mass produce stuff with a lot of tolerances all over the place. This was the best. He went to go work with them, and they were talking about they're having a meeting, and they're in their meeting at the factory, and they need to expand. And every big company like that, there's a party member who's on the board of directors, the way it works. There's a party member, is a member of that. And they're talking about, we could need to expand. And there was a next door, there was a residential area, like small, like kind of like huts or sort of like smaller homes and stuff like this. And they're like, yeah, it would be nice if we could expand into that area. You know, if we could make deals with them and get the property there, and then we could build more factory and build more warehouses. And like, is that agreed? Like, yeah, let's go. This is what we need to do. Next steps. And he says, I went to work the next day, that afternoon, and that lot was empty.
They get stuff done.
Knock, knock. You gotta go.
Jesus. Yeah. Time to move. That is crazy. You want to know what else is crazy? The relationship we have with you, the listener. Why I think to myself, I must be going nuts trying to get you guys all of the entertainment that you deserve each and every Monday. And the way that you guys repay us is at patreon.com/weirdthings. Head on over there now. Get your custom RSS feed. Make sure that you never miss an episode. And get some custom Discord rewards as well. Patreon.com/weirdthings.
Gentlemen.
Yes.
Can you smell that? Can you smell that?
Is it hydrazine? Because I can run very fast.
No, Brian. It's not hydrazine. This is phosphine.
Phosphine?
I know. Exciting. Exciting. Phosphine in the Venus atmosphere.
I don't know what phosphine is, but I know that phosphorescence is. Does it glow? Is it a glowy thing?
Well, Brian, I'm going to pretend to know all about phosphine because I read the article about phosphine. Oh, sure. Geez. What about their early works? You know, about the European album? That was really good. So phosphine is a gas that they've detected in the atmosphere of Venus, and scientists say that it's usually indicating life.
Oh, that's interesting. So go on. It would be the equivalent. Like I know that oxygen is one of those things that that you pretty much don't get oxygen without something making oxygen, something living making it, right? Which is why
large amounts of it. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Which is why we're able to look at exoplanets. And if we're ever able to find a exoplanet with a whole bunch of oxygen, that almost certainly would be an indication of life on there. Right.
Yeah. And just as a note, and I'm totally not reading from this Wikipedia, in the pilot episode of Breaking Bad, Walter White knocked out Crazy 8 and killed Emilio Coyoma by generating phosphine gas.
That's a good pull.
Yeah. So the presence of it, it seems to be, it's, you know, a thing. As far as we understand it, it's generally produced through like organic chemistry, and to detect it large amounts, some scientists are saying that that'd be one of the things we consider a hallmark for some sort of organic process, some form of life. This is from Astronomicals.
So life on Venus. Life on Venus, something that now more likely based on the detection of this gas.
How do you think that looks? I would imagine that, and this is me making up stuff. Stop me if you've heard me do this before. But like, you know, there's talk about everything from I don't know, floating clouds of organic matter on Jupiter or whatever. It seems like we all know that the surface of Venus is a hellscape, but we also know that at some point there's going to be a Goldilocks zone. And so it doesn't seem like the craziest thing to just imagine sort of a floating, like an ionosphere of green things that are making it, maybe. I don't know.
Yeah, it's entirely possible. You know, one of the things that we kind of forget is that you can take air samples as high up as you can get air, which actually goes, even extends, like you find air molecules even past the International Space Station. I think we've talked about this before, that the ISS actually changes the pitch of its solar panels at certain parts of its rotate orbit because of drag. And the tiny presence, but like we find stuff up our atmosphere. You know, we find little things, little buggers living up there that sometimes waft from down here, but we don't know a lot about upper atmosphere sort of, you know, biology as much as we, you know, probably are going to learn. And we also know that things can sort of, you know, we get like solar winds go by and will strip away parts of our upper, like little small pockets and bubbles of like our upper atmosphere. And they go towards other places, Mars. So there's different, there's asteroids hitting us and sending debris elsewhere, but there's also the exchange of some of parts of atmosphere to other places. So it's possible that you could have life could see from here to there, from Mars to here to there, et cetera.
Well, and we've even, so, you know, speculated about, wondered what it might look like for, you know, kind of a cloud city, floating city on over, mm-hmm. you know, obviously you would never want to fall down into Venus, but at some point, there has to be a Goldilocks, fairly pleasant temperature, if not atmosphere, mm-hmm. that maybe is cozy to some kind of critter that's able to make something.
Well, and we have, you know, we have life that lives in geothermal vents. You know, we have extremophiles. Yeah. And so that was a big, that realigned a lot of our thinking of where we thought life was possible. And then we keep looking everywhere. We find, you know, we talk about lithotropes, life that lives within rocks and that eats rocks, et cetera. And so it's hard to say, like, other than we get the complete breakdown of chemistry. I don't know, or the complete breakdown, or almost no molecular motion. I'm hesitant to say what the limit would be.
Well, and we certainly know that there's more energy in Venus, full stop. You know, being closer to the sun, being bathed in you know, all that sunlight. Like if I was just gonna imagine where I'd find a microscopic critter, I think I might pick Venus before Mars.
Well, remember that, and the thing that works really to Venus's favor is the atmosphere trapping the heat, and that's why Mercury gets colder than Venus does, because Mercury is much closer to the sun than Venus is. So, but, you know, Venus having that thick atmosphere, which one means you get the heat trapping effect, but also thick atmosphere means chemicals, other things. And we're used to thinking of our atmosphere as sort of static. We have our atmosphere, we get some cloud layers and stuff, although we know it's not really like that for stratosphere and stuff like that. And Venus, it's going to be much more, you got to think of your atmosphere almost like an ocean, like layers to an ocean, and completely different gradients, completely different chemical compositions and stuff, weather patterns above weather patterns, et cetera.
And if I'm remembering right, Venus is tidally locked, where a day is longer than a year. So there's one side that's kind of constantly always being baked or whatever. So I don't know, that to me sort of opens up even more possibility of if we're, you know, just postulating a microscopic something or other. A lot of Goldilocks zones, I would imagine.
Yeah, it's not tidally locked. It orbits actually counterclockwise, like the way we orbit, and also with the atmosphere, the convection from that pushes heat around it traditionally.
Oh shoot! Okay, so yeah, so there's plenty of spinning happening. Yeah, in there. There's no cold.
Yeah, I don't
parts.
Know if there was. Yeah, no. It's like that's where Mercury's fascinating, because like Mercury gets like. There are parts, and Mercury's not tidal locked either, but Mercury has polar points that, like, when you have a slight axis, that stay in shadow for periods of time, and you could probably get snow on Mercury.
Wow.
You know, or ice at some points there.
I remember in one of the Star Wars books, Lando Calrissian was running a mining operation on a Mercury-like type planet where basically it was just a giant tank that was just, you know, constantly staying on just the edge of the sun coming up mm-hmm. over it. So where it's like, hey, weather's fine here as long as we keep on moving. It's me, another crazy scheme of mining. Lando.
Mining so, Baron, Lando Calrissian.
But a Venus day is 243 Earth days.
Yeah.
So.
Damn.
So
it's a long shift.
I was gonna say, yeah.
So phosphines are.
I think that would finally benefit me for just telling people that I'll get to it tomorrow.
Yeah, I'm at the Venus tomorrow.
Hey, that's gonna be like smash cut to me at the IRS building. Like, all right.
What do you expect? It's only Monday.
It's only Monday. Handcuffs. Take me up to jail. Stunning defense, falls flat.
So when we see, apparently when we see, when we encounter phosphine in nature, it is organically produced. And so that's where we're like, oh, there. But of course, like, we've got this literal oven with an entirely different environment, atmosphere, and chemical makeup on Venus. It's sort of like, we maybe life, maybe a chemical process that we haven't had the opportunity to observe yet because we haven't, you know, run that model.
I guess that's a similar. Isn't most of the methane on planet Earth created by organic life? Whereas, you know, Titan has entire, you know, methane rainfalls and rivers and lakes of it and stuff.
Exactly. And that's one of the things where when we look at, like, because there is the argument, there's an argument, like, there, and I don't know how much weight it still holds about talking about, like, how much of, like, our natural gas was actually produced from organic matter versus abiotic, whatnot. And there is some debate as to, like, do we really fully understand some of the geoscience behind that? Because did we just sort of settle in to say this is the way it's done? And I heard some of it kind of been debunked, but it was this interesting idea.
I remember listening. This is some Coast to Coast AM, middle of the night AM radio stuff. There was somebody very passionately saying that, talking about abiotic crude oil, like he was saying, like, yeah, you know, we call it a fossil fuel because we assume it's all dead, decayed matter, but that's not it. It's there's all of it that we will ever need forever, and there will never be peak oil or whatever.
Yeah, that was an argument for a while, and I haven't followed up to see that, and because I read one of these things, like, no, this is why it's not true, whatever. I'm like, I don't know. But I do know that we have plenty of oil right now and plenty of natural gas, and it's 2020 and we're supposed to have run out of all those things by now. But also sort of thinks that, like, very interesting. Very interesting.
Yeah. In my imagination, like, Andrew gets far enough into the article to just say, yeah, I'm not writing that book right now. And then just keeps on going to the next one.
Yeah. Okay, cool. Science, yay. Let me know when you have an answer. But it is exciting. And I mean, it's exciting too, because where we are right now with, we're literally watching, you know, in, you know, SpaceX is planning to do a 60,000 foot hop with their, you know, in the next week or two.
With a proper nose cone. Like looking like a real spaceship, not just the random floating grain silo that we've seen so far.
Yeah, and there was let me see what the latest is. So for those of you who don't know,
although it's space, it does even with the nose coated. I mean, just it. I deeply adore how homegrown that thing looks. It just looks like someone went out there with some 10-penny nails and a dream. And I know there's so much more to it, but I love how rough hewn it appears.
Yeah. So from Elon 2 days ago, SN8, the serial number 8, that each one of these things you see hopping, they've got different versions. And we watched, they're always building the next one. So see one blow up and it's like, all right, roll the other one out, you know, and that's sort of the beauty of it. It's not like the one prototype we have that we've, the NASA approach should be like, make sure you measure every single, you know, every single seam 10 times, do this, whatever. There's reasons for doing that. But the SpaceX approach is like, yes, take due caution, build it well, but just test a thing. Just put it on the stand and see what happens.
I mean,
and sometimes
just,
it goes floating.
It's just so dented and homespun. It looks like it's about to start singing in a third grade play. I love it.
Oh, God. I remember, like, if I made this as a prop and I showed up, you know, the producers came to see this thing, I'd get fired.
Yes,
like, yeah. I know. Yeah.
But did you ever look at the space shuttle up close?
Oh, sure. Yeah. No, it's those individual tiles look like they were stolen from a Passover ceremony. I mean, they're all like little biscuits.
It looks like it's paper mache. Looks like you see these things, you look at the side and it looks quilted and even. I'm like, and you get closer, you're like, oh. Like, this is not, I wanted to see something sleek and cool, but as you know, SpaceX's attitude on this is like, we just need these things to have fuel tanks and engines right now. We'll worry about making the thing smooth and pretty later on. Let's just, because part of it too, it's like our reaction to this. Imagine if you were, you know, Lockheed or whatever, and you NASA brought in Senator so-and-so to go take a look at this thing, and they're like, you know, we gave you $10 billion for this, you know?
Yeah, but that's the difference in the business model, right? Like Boeing and Lockheed aren't doing stuff on spec, and if they are, it's going to be something that they are going to put a gigantic price tag on, so no one can see the stuff until it all looks awesome.
So there was a Eric Berger as a comment. He writes on Ars Technica, talks about space. He the quote for the headline was, Charlie Bolden says the quiet part out loud, SLS rocket will go away. So Bolden, who was head of NASA for a previous NASA administrator, he had said back when there was talk about like SLS, which is the rocket we have spent billions and billions of dollars.
This was going to be like the next generation space shuttle, right?
Which was derisively, although not unfairly, nicknamed the Senate launch system, because a classic boondoggle.
So in space shuttle, in a sense that totally not reusable, totally, you know, they were basically it was a works program for like previous shuttle contractors and stuff. So in 2000, this Berger had sort of some comment at this, because he interviewed Bolden back in 2014, and he asked him, and this is 2014, he had asked, why was NASA investing so much in SLS when SpaceX was using its own funds to develop the lower cost Falcon Heavy rocket? Bolden said at the time, let's be very honest, we don't have a commercially available heavy lift vehicle. The Falcon 9 Heavy may someday come about. It's on the drawing board. SLS is real.
That one, you can add that one to freezing cold takes. That one did not age well.
Yeah, yeah. So those of you didn't know, the Falcon Heavy's launched twice now. SLS, the best case scenario is at least end of next year before it will launch, which nobody really expects that. And it's yet we've had the second time within like 12 months of another multi-billion dollar cost overrun.
Man, what's it got to be like to be part of the team doing that, where it's like you just know, and that's got to be a rough gig.
It's a cozy gig, they can be really, really sad in a new house because they know they are going to be getting X amount of money for Y amount of time, and that's what it is. I mean, the relationships that these kinds of companies have with the federal government is not one where they got to worry about like making a thing being on time or on budget.
I've watched, and like Berger, I love Berger's coverage, because I've watched him cover for the over years, and there's that always that like, well, you know, Elon Musk says a lot of stuff he needs to deliver, you know, Elon Musk says, and which is true, it's like, you know, this guy is like, I'm gonna build electric cars and rockets and wire your brain. I'm like, all right, slow down there, buddy. And then there has been this sort of like, let's see
colonies beneath the ground.
But as he's delivered, and I think that there was these, you sort of, a lot of people sort of step back and be like, I've seen critics now go, yeah, no, we're on board with the space part, at least, whatever. But this is Berger's not a guy, as far as I know, to sort of throw shade, but this is what he says about, he has a caption, a title here, it says view of the SLS outside the bubble. And it talks about like the Falcon Heavy is not as capable of SLS, but can do a ton of the missions SLS is meant for. But then the last sentence in the first paragraph, the SLS will cost about $2 billion to launch and then fall into the ocean.
Yeah.
I wasn't actually the mission statement for it, but it is this.
Well, and look, I think it's a credit. It's a credit to where we are in terms of rocketry that is a punchline and not a like, well, of course. But where else would you want a rocket?
Where else would your 737 go? You get on over Paris and fall, jump out, all the passengers parachute out, and then it crashes in the Alps somewhere.
Yeah. I forgot, they've done 3 Falcon Heavy launches. I've got another one coming up, I think sometime next year, too. And that was, so what is interesting, I think it's worth mentioning, too, the Falcon Heavy took longer to develop because they were going to do some interesting stuff like cross feed, like have fuel going from the side rockets into the main rocket and some other sorts of stuff, which they dialed back on. And Elon Musk could, you know, because he originally thought like, oh, I'd be like just three rockets strapped together. And he's like, no, it's more complicated than that. But also, they improved the efficiency of the Falcon 9 like by 30 or 40% of the amount of the payload capacity, where they thought they would need the Falcon Heavy to do a lot of these heavier payloads. And it turned out the Falcon 9 could be made even more efficient. And that was one of the reasons why it took them, you know, one of the reasons why the push towards the Falcon Heavy wasn't as much, was they were surprised by the performance of that.
That's crazy.
So I'm wondering now, I can go to the capability and services and see, like, what does it cost to, oh, okay, to a Falcon Heavy launch, 8 metric tons to a GTO, geosynchronous transfer orbit, $90 million.
8 metric tons. How close is a metric ton to what I think of as a ton, 2,000 pounds?
Yeah, we can call it the same.
Pretty much. Well, okay, whatever. So 8 tons. So yeah. Okay, let's think in terms of Jeeps. You can send up.
It's all of Brian's math. All of Brian's math is Jeep related. Set up, it's just, well, I don't know. I mean, based on my calculations, that's 18 Jeeps and 3 Weinmaraners.
Weinmaraners.
Yeah. And 2 hard drives with the Abyss carry the Hearthstone and Eureka.
Yeah, throw in some iPads and we're about covered. All right. Yeah, I got it. All right. Works. Oh,
so yeah, $90 million to do. Again, there are configurations for SLS which are going to be heavier payloads than the Falcon Heavy can carry, that's for sure. But also, if you knew you were gonna have the Falcon Heavy capability, then you probably would have designed payloads to that, to match that. And that was a lot of NASA things. NASA's like, oh well, you know, we have to have the SLS because this thing's only going to fit on the SLS. Why did you design it for that? You know, reason, because we wanted to have the SLS. You know,
it's
like
just, it's just a bygone era, right? Yeah. And I think that's it's a credit to the private space industry that we've moved the needle. The needle has been moved as far as it is, but it also shows you exactly why the needle was stuck in the position that it was stuck in for as long as it was, because these are, you know, you are deciding these kinds of things that are only really decided once every several years based on factors that aren't exactly propulsive, to use a rocket pun.
So here's one of the examples, like tomorrow it could send to low Earth orbit. Again, I was using the GTO, which is the transfer thing, to low Earth orbit, 140,000 pounds. 140,000 pounds.
I don't know, how many Jeeps is that?
Oh, 30, maybe 30. 30 Jeep Cherokees.
30, 30, 30, 30, 30 perfect. Jeeps.
Perfect.
Yeah.
That'd be great, a fleet.
Like, I can't wait to Star Brian.
Go, fire, Jeeps.
Brian, in 10 years, when you sell like Modern Rogue to Warner, and you just get like this gigantic payout, this like $1 billion buyout, and you're just like, well, Brian, what do you do next? And he's just like, oh, I know. Like Van Halen starts playing. It's 30 Jeeps just spread out into space.
Wait, is that a Weimaraner in a spacesuit? He asked for it. He asked for it. And so when you have the former head of NASA sort of quietly saying, because like, basically it's going to go away, meaning all of that money, which, you know, like,
well,
said,
but again, you don't get to know who the winner was going to be in advance. You know, I mean, it's like,
I don't know, maybe some inner city STEM schools, you know,
the thing here isn't one person winning or losing. Ultimately, the greatest benefit to this is some of the military industrial complex being loosened, at least in terms of space exploration. It's a win for people who want more space exploration. It's a win for people who want more science done. And it's a win for people that don't believe that this kind of money should just be written off out of the federal budget. So,
well, yeah,
I think the big win is that we have a gigantic failure that this didn't even come close to being competitive with other off the rack options.
Yeah, like, that's the a problem's massive not win. That the problem's not that we wanted to build a big giant rocket. That's great. I love that. The problem was is that it's the cost plus the idea that we went to some contractors and said, "You've got the gig." And you've known over decades that unfortunately, if you don't deliver on time and it keeps changing and keeps having cost overruns, we're still going to pay for it. What do you think will happen? And that's the frustrating part. Not that we wanted to build this ambition. You know, SLS on paper, to have a big heavy lift rocket like that would be great. The way we went about doing it, completely wrong. And we got exactly what the program was designed for, to keep putting money into these contractors for years and never deliver anything. And then what finally they ever did, a $2 billion per launch thing, you know. And there's, you know, people made that thing like, well, like, you know, we didn't know reusability was a thing. Like, nobody was spending money on reusability. No, nobody. We stopped spending money on genuine reusability like in the early 70s when we realized that the space shuttle was supposed to be a fully reusable rocket. And we realized to get this thing done in time, we had to cut some corners. And ever since then, it was off the table. For the most part, you put like money in Delta Clipper and some other things, but it was just never enough. Picks.
I finally started watching season 2 of The Boys. You guys watching The Boys on Amazon?
Brian, my pick is season 1 of The Boys because Ashley hadn't seen it.
Oh, right.
So
on.
I am rewatching season 1 of The Boys, and let me tell you this. I was just as charmed in this go round as I was on the first time that I watched it. Some of the ideas of the first season are obviously very much inspired by the time in which they were written. They were very much about a certain point in history. Others, I think, have aged exceptionally well, including the idea of like Disney becoming a defense contractor. By and large, man, the cast just so well cast. Like there's not a character in that show that we come to where I'm like, oh, we have to do a thing with them now. Like everyone's got at least some kind of nuance, and the people that are really well cast are just out of this world to me. Like they are iconic.
Yeah. I had a friend ask if, he got like 4 episodes into it and he expressed that it was just too dark and awful and asked whether or not, there ever was any joy. And by being so dark and so awful, so early, it really does buy them the rest of the season to get a little bit wacky at times, and going into the second season, maybe a little lot wacky and still not minding it, because of just how harsh that opening is. I'm enjoying the second season quite a bit.
My pick is, I'm going to tell you a little helpful feature. Suppose you're watching like classic Star Trek episodes with your girlfriend who's never seen them before. And then you're like, yeah, you know, there's a whole culture of people who literally have built extremely realistic sets and make their own episodes and will even hire former cast members or the children of cast members to be in their Star Trek fan films. And you decide to show them this on YouTube and you realize, oh man, I should have paused my watch history.
Why? Oh, because now you're getting fed nothing but fan films.
Now you're getting all of these. So the YouTube watch history. Yeah, highly recommend using that to pause things so that you don't get recommendations of, I don't know, every friggin' Star Trek fan film made ever. Have you seen the level of I was watching one and I'm like there's called what, like Star Trek Continues, which like they've got like a full set for the bridge, they've got a med bay set, they've got a transporter room set. They've got the conference room set. Like they've got like, I don't know. I'm sure somebody here knows the full story on this, but like, I imagine like somewhere like North Carolina, somebody's built their entire, you know, we talked about before about the whole Axnar thing where people, you know, they wanted to make a Star Trek fan film and they started raising money on it, like a legit film to build a studio and stuff. And Paramount's like, we we think this kind of crosses a line, you know? But there still are Star Trek fan films and stuff, and holy crap, the production quality on these things.
I mean, I'm going to make some guesses about the acting quality, but I'm going to make other guesses about what a freaking blast they're probably having. it has to be so much fun.
Well, I was watching one, and you see like Chris Doohan, who's Jimmy Doohan's like son, who, you know, he plays his dad's role on them. He'll go in and do this. And then Grant Imahara was playing Sulu. You know, I'm like, oh yeah, that's right. Grant's like, was like a super big Trek fan. And, you know, it's like, I wonder who we're going to cast him as. Oh, okay, well, I guess we could just, you know, follow that trend. But, you know, that's the thing, too. It's like, maybe they're out there, but I'm like, I want to see, like, the gender-bending versions of stuff. Like, I want to see, like, let's not continue the 1968 show. Let's redo this show in some other kind of cool way. But maybe that's not the point.
I kind of wonder also, like, at a certain point, do we look at those as like repertory properties, like, and obviously there's like an element of like trying to make money off it, but just saying like, oh, in the same way that Shakespeare is just a thing that people need to do if they are like certain actors, if you want to make sci-fi films, should it just be like a rite of passage that you direct a Star Trek script or something like that, or should we have public access sets that people can go and shoot this kind of stuff on, and should we then take the same kind of licenses that you do with Shakespeare that's been done to death, and so that's why you get the modern version or the medieval or the you know, whatever version.
Yeah, I mean, you are describing my paradise that legally cannot happen, but only exists.
Well, legally you can't make money on it, right?
Well, yes,
like, legally you can't make money on it, and you can't call it blank. But it's like, all right, to a certain extent, if it's just spaceship, the journey to adventure,
yeah,
and everyone's doing the same thing.
I'm gonna trademark spaceship, the journey to adventure.
Well, yeah, Paramount is actually, and you know, you'll see stuff like people were angry when they like shut down like Axnar or whatever. But I mean, that was like, I would say that's an example where you literally had people paying themselves salaries and to release a product using the Star Trek IP in ways that I would say really push the limits of what would be acceptable fandom kind of thing. Because it's like, what's the difference between that? And that's the sort of thing is you have to say, like, I go raise money to go make, I'm going to make a Star Trek, we're calling a fan film, but I'm going to get paid. I'm going to do this. We're going to use this IP and we're going to sell videos and merchandise and stuff. Problematic, you know, because then you're, what do copyrights mean at that point? But you have a lot of latitude. Like, you look at, if you want to pull up, Bryce, pull up, if you can, you know, we had somebody in the chat room, you're like, oh, I love Star Trek Continues. Like, it looks, you freeze a frame. It looks like some people faithfully acting out, and the lighting was just as Technicolor super bright as it was in the 60s show. And it is a weird kind of nostalgia here, but like, they do multiple episodes of this thing, you know, and like you see the sets and stuff and all that. And like that looks
holy
like
crap.
Classic.
Yeah. Looks great.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Looks like classic Trek, you know, it looks like.
Yeah, I guess, like, is there a 2020 version of community theater for something like this?
Yeah, but even like, community theater charges a ticket price. So it's like,
but also they charge for the book, right? Like, you know, if you want to do a thing, you have to pay the rights to get the thing. So it's like there is some level of sub copyright blessing.
Yeah, like if you want to do Grease, you just have to pay $5 per script for everyone in your
whatever
high school production.
Or if you want to do a community theater thing, like there's money to do it.
Isn't this that version though? Because now you have people who go they put together the money to do their own costumes, do their stuff. Somebody's got sets that they can rent, and then they go to cons, and the cons have like whole like screenings of stuff there, and you put it out there on YouTube and stuff. And I mean, I think we kind of have that in a sense.
Yeah, I guess. Yeah. And I'm not familiar enough with it to know exactly where we're at. But that seems like that's what it is.
There's a Star Trek The Next Generation one. And you've got to see this because it is like it starts off. They have their own version of the bridge. And there's this skinny, bald guy playing, you know, the part of the Picard guy. He's got a British accent. There's a Riker looking dude and this very Anna Sturtis thing. Swear to God, you think it's an opening to a porn. the way this, you look at this like Star Trek Next Generation fan film, like
it definitely almost, like, not the Next Generation.
Yeah, it's just the unauthorized thing. If you find that one, like that was just this, you know, my brain, like neurons in my brain started melting. Yeah. I'm like, is this feels like the Turkish? There actually is like Turkish language versions too.
Bryce, please go forth and find the Next Generation fan film that looks most like pornography.
I did find this one, A Tale of Two Cities, and the description says it was originally made as a porn parody with the porn scenes removed. So I don't know exactly if this is what you're looking for, Andrew, but it's called
Maybe, go back to that, would explain if you go back to like where you see the bridge crew or whatever.
Yeah.
Yes, that explains everything now. Okay. Thank God. I'm like, why does this feel like a porn? It was.
It was actually a porn.
I mean, wow, the
on YouTube, but this was on this is on YouTube. So if you go look, yes, like that's good. Yeah, I'm a YouTube. Not normally where I look to find porn. But yeah. Oh my God. Yep. That's hilarious.
Yep. I mean, oh my goodness. We're seeing some very particular hair Deanna, shots.
Now when Deanna Troi went,
it makes sense.
Were there a lot of Star Trek scenes that took place in bedrooms?
Yes.
Oh, okay.
Yes.
In quarters, yeah.
If you go watch, like, in the menagerie, there's a scene where Captain Pike goes and lays down his bed and the doctor walks in and you're like, this looks like... this is weird, you know? Like, what are you doing here? Yeah, I heard you needed to rest. I'm like, oh, geez, you know? But he only gave him a martini, so.
That's amazing.
God, makes so much more sense now. Oh, geez. Thank you for solving that mystery for me.
Dude, do you feel just like a big release of all that tension you were carrying?
All right. Bryce, you got a pick?
Oh, sure. Yeah, I got a pick. I spent over the weekend watching the new episodes of the Netflix original cartoon anime, Agretzko. Season 3 has Agretzko obsessed with a virtual reality boyfriend, loses all of her money on microtransactions, and then ends up having to take a side gig that she is not entirely comfortable with, and then learns a little bit about herself.
About Star Trek.
Kind of not a stretch. This third season of Agretzko is very interesting because it's very clear, like, no, she's not like a very good friend at all, and everyone is just saying it. And so this is a weird ending point for season 3. But it's such a cute show, and it's you know, they're like 10 episodes and all of them are 10 minutes long or something like that. So you can get through it really quickly. But I'm really digging it. Agretzko on Netflix.
Nice.
Can I just do a little tack on pick too? Is that Lower Decks continues to delight.
It's better than it ought to be. Like, it has no right to be as good as it is. It's become like must watch family viewing for us. And I don't understand why the IMDb rating isn't higher, because it's note perfect. It's so good.
Well, it's a religion. And so, you know, you look at like the review card, which I thought Picard was enjoyable. I enjoyed Picard, but you get people who are angry at, like, you know, how could they do this to the Federation? Ah, it's not what it means. It's like, oh,
I mean, geez, have you seen the Metacritic on the New Testament?
Yeah. And that was like, if you look at like on The Boys, like a net and within Amazon, the rating for that is like within the own Amazon scoring system, it's like 3 stars, 3.5.
Well, and that was a big news story because people were review bombing it because they didn't drop the entire season at once.
Oh, interesting.
And yeah. So now it's at, I was wondering at 3 stars.
Why they did that. Yeah.
Yeah. That makes more sense now. So,
I'll tell you what, the joy of Lower Decks is that the joke isn't remember this. Like, they're really with heart building real episodes with punchy dialogue and fast moving stories in the vein of Star Trek. And you don't have to know nothing about Star Trek to really get a kick out of it. If you know, some of the jokes will punch a little bit harder if you happen to know it, but otherwise highly recommended.
Yeah. I don't want to bag on like Discovery, but like season 2 of Discovery just drove me nuts because it was like there's a storyline where the very beginning you're like, be like, oh, this mystical thing. I'm like, well, we know who that is. We know where this is going to go. And now I got to watch this whole thing unfold for us to get to this point and go, oh, look. And you're like, yeah. Remember when Star Trek was like cool, kind of standalone episodes, and every now and then we got an arc, you know, and it wasn't like all arc, you know, no standalone. And
but you were like excited for like, oh, I wonder if that's the same thing as the thing before. Like I'm excited because I'm picking up this breadcrumb in a world where breadcrumbs shouldn't exist, as opposed to just dumping uncooked Thanksgiving stuffing on the table and being like, look, breadcrumbs.
Yeah.
I wonder if it'll eventually be a loaf.
Yeah. I have you seen any of the stills and stuff for Strange New Worlds?
Mm-mm.
So that's the other new Star Trek series they're launching with Anson Mount playing Christopher Pike. And it's before Kirk had the Enterprise. And so that's the new spinoff from Discovery. And so that's going to be kind of interesting. I hope they're going to do like more standalone stuff, but some like Rebecca Romijn Stamos, she's going to play number one. If you remember, hey nerds, remember, you know, the Menagerie, remember the original crew before Kirk, you know, was Spock with Pike and then the woman, Majel Barrett's character, number one, et cetera. So here's hoping, you know, when it's, Star Trek's good, it's really fun.
Yeah.
When it's not. It's been weird.
The Diamond Club hopes you have enjoyed this program.